We ready? I will open the Senate Committee on Rules. Since we do not have a quorum at this time, I'm simply opening it as a subcommittee of the full committee for the purpose of public hearing. I expect quorum here any moment. While we only have one of the three bills that you might be able to find online up for consideration, SB 30, please note that the relating clause for all three bills is relating to ethics. And note, too, that we have nine different amendments that actually copies have been provided. There will be amendments to SB 30. And so your comments on any of these things are appropriate at this time. There's no limitation as long as you are simply commenting on ethics related to public officials. So I'm going to start off. We went a little bit over last time, and we had some invited testimony that had not concluded. So I will go first to that invited testimony. Then I will go to two of the parties that have come from the longest distances to be here, and then I will go to the remainder of the parties that are on the list. Ms. Snyder from the Association of Oregon Counties, if you'd come forward, and Mr. Winkles from the League of Oregon Cities. And if you could please just provide your testimony, and obviously we will still be working on this legislation for at least a couple more weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Paul Snyder, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. I have some submitted testimony that I think you should be receiving now. It's dated February 3rd, and it identifies issues that we think should be addressed by the committee and the legislature with respect to the ethics laws. But I'd like to just begin, if I may, with a couple of overall comments. First of all, I'd like to commend the work group that Dexter Johnston worked with in identifying, collating, and boiling down from local officials.
Somebody's got a cell phone.
Yes, mine is off, actually. I believe it's off. We have an interesting circumstance in this hearing room. Cell phones, even if they are on, just vibrate. As long as they are on, they interfere with the audio system. So if you'll please turn your cell phones off. Snyder, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to commend the Ethics Commission staff for the work that they've done in working with us, with the Association of Oregon Counties and other local government organizations, and with public officials to be responsive and timely and instructive to the extent that they could in addressing the issues that surround the latest ethics law changes. I'd also like to commend the interim committee for going the extra mile and holding the hearings that it held and listening to the comments made by local officials, including going all the way to Pendleton. That was noticed and appreciated by the folks in Eastern Oregon. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we've identified a number of issues that we think should be addressed. And the first one in the submitted testimony in paragraph A relates basically to exclusion of family members from the statement of economic interest. And I believe that's been addressed by Senate Bill 30. We think that's an improvement. The second is a recommendation that we would suggest that the requirement to file quarterly disclosure statements by local officials either be eliminated or in some way significantly restricted, especially if there are no changes. We'd recommend the elimination of that provision simply because local public officials don't usually have that kind of economic activity over a period of a year that these provisions seem to be intended to address. And the third one is a big one. It may be the biggest of all. And that is to define, redefine legislative or administrative interest. And the problems that we've had with that relate to the difference between the existing definition and the way it's applied in current law. The existing definition talks about the ability of a local official to somehow influence the economic plight of an individual. And if you can have an economic influence on someone, then that someone has a legislative or administrative interest in you. So far, so good. But when that definition is applied in the statutory law, it says legislative or administrative interest in the governmental agency. So it's no longer related to the ability of the local official or the public official to influence something economically. It relates to the whole agency. And when that happens, that's where some of the very, very odd and unhappy results occur. So if it's the governmental agency, I can recall to you a conversation that I listened to from a state agency head who said, my agency has 10 divisions, and one of those divisions relates to the regulation of a particular industry. There's a young man who's dating a secretary in another division, and he's employed by that particular industry. I have trouble having to say to her, he can't take her to the movies. It doesn't make any sense. And I think the nexus of the problem relates to that broad use of the definition of legislative or administrative interest. If it were just, if you just took the definition, and the amendments do that, I think they go a long way toward doing that, to say that the legislative or administrative interest should focus on the capacity of the individual public official to influence an individual or an organization economically. And if you have got that ability, then that person or that organization has a legislative or administrative interest in you. And that, I think, would help a great deal. We had a couple other suggestions to narrow the gift limit as they're applied to relatives. Once again, however, I think that narrowing of the definition of legislative or administrative interest would also still go a long way toward addressing that issue. Maybe not far enough, but at least a long way. And a couple more. This has to do with advisory groups. We have a lot of them. So do you. So does the governor's office. So do state agencies. I either serve on or work closely with advisory groups to several state agencies. And one of them, in particular, I just thought it would be fun to talk with a couple people who are from the private sector who serve on an advisory group to the same state agency that I serve with. And I said to the first one, who's a lawyer, said, do you consider yourself to be a public official of this agency for purposes of the ethics laws? And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're an advisory group to the agency. You're serving the agency within the definition of public official. It could very well be that you are a public official within the meaning of the ethics laws, in which case the gift limits that apply to this agency also apply to you. The prohibitions against entertainment, if it affects someone who's got a legislative or administrative interest in this agency, also applies to you. And she said, well, I never thought about it. I think that's common. If we take a look at the Guide to Public Officials that was developed by the Ethics Commission staff, it estimates that there are 200,000 public officials in the state of Oregon. And with the expanded definition of relative that occurred in the 2007 legislative session, I just sat down and tried to imagine a typical family to figure out how many people would be related under that definition to a public official as it's defined. And I came up with 14. I think, well, first of all, you take the parents of the public official. You take the parents of the public official's spouse. If you assume that there are three siblings in that family, and all of them are married, then each public official has got six relatives on his side, six relatives on his spouse's side, and then you have the children. Put them all together, I get around 14. Well, 14 times 200,000 is 2.8 million people. That's a lot of folks who are either public officials or relatives of public officials.
Well, it leaves about 900,000.
And I really just don't believe that that was the intent of the legislature in 2007, nor do I believe that that serves any legitimate public purpose. It just sets up a whole lot of people for catastrophe who don't even know that this law applies to them. And so, in terms of defining public official, we think you ought to exclude from that anybody who serves on an advisory group if the advisory group has no capacity to bind the governmental body or to act for the governmental body. And that takes all these advisory groups out of the definition of public official, and we're free once again to invite people who are influential in the community, who are business people, to give advice to the government without thereby becoming subject to the ethics laws as public officials. The next one that we have is to clarify that an individual resides with a public official. For purposes of defining a member of a household, if the person's domicile or place of abode is the same as the public official's, I think that's what that was intended to mean anyway. And we've asked the Ethics Commission to approve a rule that we adopted under the new ethics law that says that, but we haven't heard from them yet. Even if they agree with us, the way the ethics law applies is if it's our rule, then it only protects county officials. So if the Ethics Commission said, yep, we agree with your rule, a member of the household means people who have the same place of abode, that only protects county officials. It ought to protect everybody. So we think the law ought to be changed to say that. And the last issue that we had with respect to them, I don't think we even asked for a bill on that. But I have one more suggestion to you. That is to say, I think there's a logical and a good way to significantly reduce the workload of the Ethics Commission staff, to keep public officials out of trouble, and to allow local legal advisors to do their work and to create a good outcome. And it relates somewhat to another bill that was enacted by the legislature a few years ago. There's a law that says a public official who misappropriates public funds is personally liable for the return of the public funds. That's the way the law was up until about 4 years ago. The problem with that was there was no defense. And so if you rely in good faith on advice of your legal counsel under that old law, if you're wrong, you're personally liable to pay the money back. And that could involve not just the purchase of pencils, but it could include the issuance of bonds and certificates of participation. It could include millions and millions of dollars. And so how could a public official actually take some action in good faith reliance on the advice of a lawyer who's gone to law school and practiced law? What we did with that law, and what I'm suggesting to you that we do something similar in the ethics law, was to limit the application of it to basically malfeasance, and I have it here. What I would suggest as a parallel to that law, it's ORS 294-100. It says now it's subject to repayment by the public official if it constitutes malfeasance in office or willful or wanton neglect of duty. And the way that plays out in real terms is that if you receive advice from a lawyer who's your lawyer and you rely in good faith on it, then you're not acting with malfeasance or with willful or wanton neglect of duty. Another way to put it is to say that if a public official, before taking action under the ethics law, relies in good faith on the advice of legal counsel, then that would constitute a safe harbor. Just like if it were an opinion of the Ethics Commission.
And I think that would clarify that in terms of advice of legal counsel, whose counsel?
Well, what I'm thinking of, Mr. Chair, is the legal counsel for the public body.
Okay.
Mr.
That's usually the way it comes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, all due respect to the concept of acting in reliance on your legal counsel, and I think you'd have to admit that in every contested legal case, one of the attorneys is wrong. And so you've got a 50, you may as well just flip a coin. The point is that having your own legal counsel advise you and having that become a binding safe harbor, binding not only on whomever it is that follows the advice, but binding on the Ethics Commission is a bit of a reach. I certainly would support the idea that counsel would solicit an opinion from the commission or the staff and have that issued in writing and have that be binding and act as a safe harbor. But there's a variety of competency levels in attorneys practicing for municipalities, and I don't know that you can say that if a person has a admission to the bar, that qualifies them to give advice for another agency, which would be the commission. It's too far a leap for me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farriola, you make a good point. What I was thinking of in terms of safe harbor was not to say that it's not a violation, but to, as a safe harbor, that there would be a mitigation of the penalty or a reduction in the penalty. Or no penalty, I don't know. But somewhere along the line, the value of this would be, first of all, when I gave kudos to the Ethics Commission staff, I was acting in appreciation for their very good responsiveness. But we do things by an exchange of email or a discussion over the phone. If I have a conversation with their staff, I always send an email confirmation about what I heard and say, if I've misunderstood what you said, please let me know right away, that kind of thing. But even that's not protection, as the committee discussed on Tuesday. The problem is, the only place right now that's a safe harbor is a commission advisory opinion, a formal opinion of the commission. And even the advice of staff of the Ethics Commission right now is not a safe harbor, although staff has said, you know, it should be a mitigation of the penalty, or it should influence to what extent the commission moves forward or recommends action by the commission. But the trouble with the situation we're in right now, we gave a presentation in March. We had Ron Burson there, and I was involved, and other lawyers. We had questions from county councils that were all funneled into us, and we did it by teleconference. What I said toward the end of that presentation was, I have an opinion, I'm a trained attorney, but bottom line is my opinion doesn't count. If there's a disagreement between me and the Ethics Commission staff, it's what their opinion is that's really going to be controlling. And so that results in an awful lot of pressure and an awful lot of workload on the Ethics Commission. If there were some way to move partway between absolution on the one hand and you're guilty and throw away the key on the other, I think it would be a public service to rely in good faith on advice of counsel.
Okay. Snyder, if you could conclude your testimony.
I'm finished, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Twing.
For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Before I get into the particulars of my testimony, I would like to address something that came up at the last hearing in regards to the Ethics Commission's response to request for advice. Of those 600 requests, a large proportion of those came from LSC members and myself personally. And I would like to compliment the Commission on getting back to us quickly. In almost every instance, I haven't always liked the advice I got or agreed with it, but they have done an excellent job in responding in a timely manner. Excuse me. The League of Oregon Cities supports a state ethics policy that is just, easily understood, and safeguards the public so as to not jeopardize the willingness or ability of private citizens to serve and effectively participate on city councils or as volunteers on boards and commissions. That's a policy statement that was approved by our general membership at our last meeting, and that's the context in which SBs 30, 31, 32, and the subsequent amendments were evaluated. As to Senate Bill 30, the League unequivocally supports the bill as written now. The requirement to list family members led to well over 200 resignations of city leaders across the state. I think you've all heard the impact from your districts and from your in the news reports, and I won't go into those in great detail, but I would point out a couple of telling examples. A city was looking to recruit a planning commissioner. I won't say where for reasons that will be obvious. The gentleman had taken his daughter into his home after she left an abusive relationship, and when he discovered that he would have to list her name as a household member on his form, the gentleman decided, and understandably so, that he could not serve in the city in a city planning commission capacity. In city councils across Oregon, public safety officers hold positions. We have in eastern Oregon, we have officials from Snake River Correctional Facilities. They clearly don't want to have their family members listed on their on forms and available in a public record, again, for obvious reasons. So we support that bill, the concept, and are appreciative of it. Senate Bill 31 clears up a lot of confusion. I think I took a lot of questions from LSC members in regards to how to fill out that form who didn't have any concept of, didn't know how to, whether they had to list five mandatorily or if they had to list garage sales, that sort of thing. So this clears up a lot of confusion and makes the process a little bit simpler. As to Senate Bill 32, the requirement that a public official only fill out a quarterly report when they have something to report, the League, I think we would characterize this as a good jumping-off point for discussions. For the majority of city officials who don't go on trips, don't go on the fact-finding missions, and would not have something to report, this would, in effect, eliminate the requirement. But for the official that is active, does go on economic development trips, I would use the example of Mayor Hughes from Hillsborough, who recently retired, going to Germany and Japan to attract Solar World and other businesses to his city. For him, I think it actually creates a more complicated situation, is that now he's tracking, do I have to report this quarter? When did I go on this trip? When did I get the expense? It does create more complications for that set of officials. And what I guess the League would ask is where's the public benefit in the QPOD for local government officials? Between executive branch officials and legislators, there's a synergy. Lobbyists report quarterly, legislators, executive branch officials report quarterly, and you can audit the reports to make sure that that the lobbyist is reporting something and the official is reporting the same thing. The people who do pay, for the rare instances where outside parties are paying for conferences and trips and fact-finding missions and those sorts of things that are reportable, the giver doesn't report on anything. And when the public body is the one providing the expenses, that's already a public record. For instance, the League of Oregon City pays expenses for its board members for some travel. We're a public agency. If somebody wants to know how much was spent, we can provide that to them. I don't know that we can articulate a true public benefit for the majority of public local government officials in filling out this form. I think it's created quite a burden, particularly for planning commissioners who really don't go on trips and are generally returning forms that are blank. As to the Amendment 30-1, which clarifies that there needs to be a nexus between the ability of a public official and to provide an economic benefit. Redefines legislative administrative interest so that a public official actually has to be able to benefit another party economically. We support that amendment wholeheartedly. Applying the legislative administrative interest agency-wide creates a great deal of confusion. There's the now famous incident of the wedding ring where a young woman was being courted by a person who had an interest in the agency she worked for. The young woman performed ministerial functions, and they had to involve their attorney into whether or not, discussions of whether or not she could accept the ring. I don't know that anyone really intended that we involve our lawyers in affairs of the heart, so to speak, when this bill was passed. I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about Amendment 30-2, which would allow a public official to accept admission to an event or food or beverages when they are simply representing their public body. The way the statute reads now, the public official may accept admission to an event and food and beverages if they appear on a formal program or if they are there to answer questions on a panel or something of that nature. That provision in law has resulted in what I would characterize as a paralysis in activity among local government officials. People are concerned that officials and city leaders are concerned that if they go to the Rotary or if they go to the chamber lunch and simply mingle or talk to business leaders or civic leaders or philanthropic leaders in their communities, that they've somehow been in violation. The 30-2 amendment goes a long way in restoring the confidence in public officials that they can in fact do these sorts of activities, represent the city council that they serve on, essentially do what the people elected them to do without fear of a violation. As to the 30-3 amendment, if the which strikes the word otherwise from the definition of a public official, we have searched high and low. We cannot currently find a position in local government that we've characterized as otherwise. I don't know, and my apologies, I'm not attempting to be flippant, but the...
We can't find it in Black's Law Dictionary either.
If the goal is to narrow the focus of who is in fact a public official and subject to the ethics law, I think this bears some further conversation. But it is certainly a step in the right direction. The amendment that I think LLC members would be most thankful for the 30-5 is 30-5, which allows a personal friend exemption in the gift limit. In local government communities across Oregon, whether they're large or small, people mingle, people socialize. City managers' kids go to school with folks who work for the chamber. There needs to be a rational way to so these people can have a reasonable social life, that someone's kids can go to the movies with their classmates, and there's no discussion of business, and there's no discussion of no quid pro quo, or no idea that they're trying to generate the favor of a city leader. The language in there is, I think, provides sufficient safeguard in that if the public official has reason to believe that the gift was provided for to curry favor, then it would fall within the gift limit. But if it's a legitimate social activity, I think it ought to be allowed. This is something that survived in the U.S. Senate Ethics Manual post-Abramoff scandal. Most other states do have a friend exemption in their statutes, and I think it would the LLC would support Oregon adopting one as well. Before I close, I would like to add the 30-9, which would allow someone to accept a gift based on outside business activities, is incredibly important to local governments. I think the provision...
Do you want to ask questions?
I do.
Yes, Senator Fairley.
I agree that there's some problem with the idea of who's covered by the gift limitation. There's ample examples about the children of elected public officials and and employees are not allowed to go to the circus together because it's a provision of entertainment. I mean, it's specifically prohibited by the law. It seems absurd. But the friend definition can, I think, err on the other side of that. And let me give you an example. I'd like to hear about how you'd respond to this. There's over 300 members of the Capital Club who are registered lobbyists. And a fair number of them are former legislators. These former legislators served with current members. And arguably, you could demonstrate without question that they were friends before they had any other relationship. They met in politics. They became friends when they had no legislative interest, because seated members don't have a legislative interest by law. And then if they do, in fact, step through that revolving door and become a lobbyist, wouldn't the friend exemption apply, since you could clearly demonstrate that they had a friendship relationship before they ever had a legislative interest?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ferrioli, what I can tell you what other jurisdictions have done to address that, and that is to create a set of criteria to analyze, so the official could analyze whether or not the gift was acceptable or not. And one would be as if the lobbyist was expensed that gift to a client, or the lobbyist at the time of the gift, there was some discussion of a matter that was before the public body. And then also the way that was that's done on the congressional limit is if the legislator and the legislator turned lobbyist could articulate a mutual exchange of gifts over the history of their relationship, that's another way that problem's been addressed as well. So those sorts of sideboards may be something that could be added.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
Will Rogers said that he never met a man that he didn't like. And I think that providing an exemption like that means that every man is my friend. And eventually you get to friends that are only very, very careful. Because there's a workaround for every example that you gave. So I would just suggest that the solution may lie in a gift limitation and full disclosure, as opposed to trying to slice and dice the categories. And a friend exemption seems to me to create as many problems as it might solve. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Ms. Twinkle, so if you can conclude in a couple minutes so we can get to some of the people that have traveled.
I will do so. By not allowing an outside business exemption to the gift limit, I think it's created some fairly significant disincentives for private citizens to serve on city councils and boards and commissions, and the inclusion of one would be advisable from the perspective of the League. Two issues that I will address very briefly that are not covered in the amendments that the League would recommend is the allowing this the a person that acts with, getting over a cold, a person who acts in good faith and reliance on the manual provided by the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, that person would be held harmless. That used to be the policy of the commission. Currently, the staff is drafting the commission, and we would like to see that public official would have a document that they could unequivocally rely on in the course of their business. And with that, I will conclude my testimony and look forward to questions.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you think, and this came out of something that Mr. Snyder said about, people being really unaware that they're even covered by the law when they're on an advisory committee or maybe even a volunteer, planning commission or something like that. I think the planning commissions probably know, but there are a lot of citizen bodies around the state that work as volunteers. Do you think that it would be, would you support putting in into this law a requirement that when someone signs up for a volunteer activity that they be given full disclosure of what the how the ethics laws apply to them and what the penalties are for the violations so that they can go in with their eyes open?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, The league conducts trainings, and we encourage our members to do so, but I think that would be advisable, what you're suggesting would be advisable, that someone operate with their with full knowledge of what their obligations are. Again, the league provides ethics training as part of one of the services we offer to members, and we've encouraged our members to do so.
Yeah, no, and follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you do, but I'm talking about before they make the decision whether to get on the board or the advisory committee. In other words, they can decide whether this is something they want to sign up for, particularly the liability that they have, which sometimes is quite significant for a misinterpretation of the law or for a violation of the law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I think that's something that the league could support for the positions that have the most exposure. I can't imagine it's a scenario where that's not taking place already, particularly for planning commissions.
So. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Sorry, we're trying to clarify something. Okay, we're going to go to two of the people that have come from the longest distance. I want to welcome back Mr. Stauffer from Enterprise, Oregon, who testified actually at our Pendleton hearing. And also Mayor Pohl from Clatskanie. Are you here? Yes, please come forward also.
Where?
Clatskanie.
Yeah, she didn't have the end. Clatskanie. I tried to read this. Okay, Mr. Stauffer, if you'd please start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, and fellow committee members, I want to thank you for allowing me this opportunity again to approach you and have this discussion about this ethics bill that I am a casualty of. For those of you that don't know, I was the chairman of the Enterprise Planning Commission, and for the information of the newspapers in the room, no, well, I did not flee.
Sorry, Mr. Stauffer. If you could just give us your name for the record.
Oh, Mark Stauffer. I thought I said that. I'm sorry.
You did, Mr. Chair.
I'm just following my committee administrators.
Unfair.
Oh, Mark Stauffer, sorry. Enterprise, Oregon, Wawa County. At any rate, for the information of the newspapers in the room, no, I did not flee. I stood on my ethical ground and said, no, I will not divulge this information because my family members said no. Ethical ground is the high ground. And I guess what I want to talk to you a little bit about today is I want you to look at this from a little bit higher plane than just the nuts and bolts of what this thing is. But I want you to think about what it has done. Now, all of you here have, like I did, taken an oath in office. And that oath says that you will swear to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon to the best of your ability. Well, the Constitution of the State of Oregon provides for home rule. Home rule allows communities to make their own decisions. I ask you today, did 97 cities and 6 counties come running to the Ethics Commission and to the legislature and saying, we have hideous people that are serving? Would you please include us? They did not. For 34 years, the people have had the opportunity, by initiative referendum, to opt into this. Did they? No, they did not. But what this bill did didn't defend the rights of the people, didn't defend the vote of the people. Now, how ethical is that? We call this an ethics bill. I submit to you that it's not an ethics bill. It's more about financial accountability. I've given each one of you this paper that's called Public Law 96-303. You should have it by now. That's an ethics law. That's what ethics are about. The vote of the people is what separates us from a lot of other governments. And the people have spoken, and we've ignored that, and we've created this thing. I give an example. Does the vote of the people work? Well, one of your fellow senators has gotten caught up in this thing, and in part because of his activities, triggered this law. He came to his people and he said, you know what? I made a mistake. I was wrong. Not only did the people return him to office, nobody ran against him. And why? Because the moral perpetuity of the people said, you're a good man. You're doing a good job, and you made a mistake. You're human. The people spoke. I wonder if you went to the Secretary of the State and asked how many people in government have been recalled by referendum over the last 10 years, how many you would find. Recalled by the people, not by a law, ethics law, that attempts to try to regulate ethics. It's not regulating ethics, really. The only thing it says about ethics in here is a little bit about that I need to declare a conflict of interest. Well, I knew that when I signed up to do that, or ex parte contact. It doesn't tell you how to be an ethical person. And we're calling it an ethics law, and it's not. So what I'm saying to you today, as you deliberate this, and as you look at this, look at the higher ground of what we have taken away from the people. We've taken away their vote. We've said, you don't understand. You don't know the people that you've put into office. And I would venture to guess that each one of you are in office. Why? Because the people put you there. They look at you and they hold you in high esteem. You're a leader. They trust you. Now, does anybody see the oxymoron here? I've just put you in office, and I said, I trust you. That's why you are there. And then we have this thing that says, we don't trust you. You're a low-down snake. You're going to lie, cheat, and steal, and financially gain anytime you want to, at every corner. Does anybody see the sad humor in that? The vote of the people, folks. We gave it away. We gave the OGEC incredible power. Under ORS 244.380, if I fail to file this SEI form, which I understand a whole bunch of people have, and are still in office, guess what? The OGEC can take my name off the name of a ballot. The OGEC can cause the county to not certify your votes of the people. The OGEC can remove you from office by not allowing you to participate. A state agency has suddenly been given the power to usurp the vote of the people and their moral perpetuity. And we've created an atmosphere of fear. I was interested to listen to some of the testimony that happened on Tuesday. And I heard, well, I voted for it because I didn't want to seem like I was against ethics. You had a bunch of people that quit, etc. This thing is creating fear. Now, I want you to stop and think a second. How many governments can you name around this world that operate by fear? Iraq? Russia? I tell you, this thing's un-American. No, I'm not Mr. Smith comes to Washington. And I know that there'll be people that chuckle that say, well, Mr. Smith came to Washington. He's naive. No, I'm not. Did I understand this thing? My wife and I spent 2 days with it. And then I spent a bunch more time with it. It's highlighted. It's tabbed. I understand every square inch of this thing, and I hate it. It's not going to do any good. If I was an immoral person and I didn't stand on what my city administrator gave me years ago, I'd just find a way around this. I'd roll the dice. I'd play the game and I'd go, well, maybe I'll get caught. Maybe they'll audit me. Maybe they won't. If you want true ethics reform in this state, do something like this. Help people to understand what is ethical conduct. Help the public to understand what to look for in ethical conduct. I am calling on you to take the high ground here. You all said this thing's a mess. Repeal it. You have that ability. I asked. I wanted to know. Because I've had individuals of the legislature tell me, oh, we don't do that. Now, how ethical is that? Act ethically. Repeal this thing. Gather the people together that have a common interest here and sit down at the table and design something that works. Not this. I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure being able to talk to you. I hope I get to continue this conversation as you deliberate this.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pohl, and then we'll go to questions.
My name is Mayor Diane Pohl. I'm from Clatskanie. Senator Devlin, committee. How do you follow that? I'm very proud to have Mr. Stauffer at my right. He's done a great job in trying to help small rural communities make sense of this assault. And that's what it has been. Senator Burdick, you asked about full disclosure to volunteers that might be wanting to serve on appointed positions. That sounds pretty good. But with the present law as you have it, we won't have any volunteers. That's the bottom line of it. If the legislature doesn't dramatically change this ethics law, you won't have any volunteer mayors. You won't have volunteer city councilmen, much less volunteer appointed folks. There's a great many mayors and councils, including my council, that stepped up with me and put our toe on the line and said, we love our community. We got elected to serve our community. We're not going to back off until we come to the legislature with a plea to fix this thing. If the legislature doesn't fix this thing, then we all will rethink it. I think that the three major pieces that you have heard from rural Oregon over and over and over again is, number one, the listing of extended family members not living with the official, but the biggest one that everyone is overlooking is the language in the original bill that says that information will be available in a searchable format for review by the public using the internet. My constituents are more than welcome to my open book. Government at the city level is the most transparent government there is. I see my people every day. They know my business all the time. That's how we work in a community. When I signed on knowing that my life needed to be transparent, and I was willing to do that for my folks. I am not willing for my information to be on there for some internet hacker in China or Florida or anywhere else to have my personal income information on the internet. We have a system in place now for public disclosure. You go to a place, you ask for the information, you sign a form, and you get that information. By putting it on the internet in a public format, you are not going to make people more ethical. What you're going to do is to drive away the ethical people that want to serve in rural Oregon. There's two paid mayors in the state of Oregon. The rest of us serve long hours willingly, and so do our city councils, our planning commissions. We do it willingly for the betterment of our community. In rural Oregon, if you violate the ethics law, you get recalled. We did that in Klatskanai. 3 PUD board members violated the ethics rule. The Ethics Commission wouldn't do a darn thing about it, even though we asked them to. So the people recalled them. In 6 weeks, 3 of them were gone, and there was an election, and they were replaced with folks that would be ethical. That's how we work it in rural Oregon. And I think that's the way that many areas work it. And I agree with defending the rights of the people. And I think that one of the overlooked remedies would be to honor the thousands of people who voted to have their elected and appointed officials abide by the ethics laws but exempted the reporting requirements. You kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater in this whole knee-jerk reaction to put a fix on something nobody really understood. We had ethics laws. If I accept gifts under the old ethics laws, I had to report those things. If I failed to report, then there was, but the problem was that the legislature denuded the Ethics Commission over the years until they had like 3 staff and they didn't have the time or they didn't have the inclination to actually enforce the ethics laws you already had on the books. And so in a knee-jerk reaction to fix it, it went completely overboard. And I don't think it was intentional. I think that it was a knee-jerk reaction. But I sincerely hope, and I've read the amendments, and they make it better. But I think I would agree with Mr. Stauffer to take a look at what actually you have accomplished with these laws. What have you accomplished? You have detrimentally harmed the ability for rural Oregon to govern itself with the best and brightest we have. We are in an economic Armageddon in rural Oregon in some areas. We just had a brand new ethanol plant close, and 35 people lost family wage jobs in a community of 2,000. That's huge to us. And we need the best and the brightest on our commissions and our city councils and our economic task forces and the different things that we're doing in our community to push just as hard as we can to make a good life for our kids and for our community members. The brightest and the best are not necessarily going to step up to the plate if they have to read pages and pages and pages of convoluted, very confusing laws that simply say one thing: be ethical. If you're caught being unethical, there's consequences. There were consequences before this even came out. They simply were not. They were not. The law was not followed. It was not enforced. So that's all I have to say. You've heard from me before, and I hope that I'll be welcome back again. I'm tremendously impassioned on this because we are fighting in rural Oregon. We're fighting hard, and many areas are for survival. And we need all the help we can get. We don't need something like this that takes away from our ability to do that. I am open for questions, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go to questions, and then I have 3 more people to testify that we're going to make sure we get to today.
Thank you.
Senator.
Just a quick statement. Of 3 years of this hearing, both of your testimonies was the most brilliant, succinct, well-stated I've heard in hours sitting in this committee. So
thank you, Senator.
For driving so far.
Thank you, Senator. It was worth every mile.
And they didn't ask to come up together. I decided to bring them up.
We're friends.
So, anything additional? Thank you both very
thank
much,
you.
Particularly for coming long distance here to testify. I'm going to bring the next 3 people up actually all together, and I'm going to start the testimony with Ms. Pellegrino. So it's Ms. Pellegrino.
Oh, she She has Lynn Lee Reese, her attorney, also.
Oh, and your an attorney is coming with you? Oh, I didn't see that. Okay. Okay, we'll just close. We'll go Ms. Pellegrino with the attorney, Lynn Lee Reese, and David Dowry from Philomath, and then we'll hear from the League of Women Voters as our last person.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino with the City of Portland. With me today is Lynn Lee Reese, Deputy City Attorney with the City of Portland. The reason I asked Lynn Lee to participate and be here today is she is the Chief Attorney responsible for answering questions relating to ethics and also has conducted dozens of trainings in the city and with council offices, with boards and commissions, with city bureaus, and is very familiar with a number of the issues that have come up. The testimony that I have submitted is a letter from the Portland City Attorney, Linda Meng, and who has oversight of all of these issues. And I've also shared the comments that the city provided over the interim to the Ethics Reform Review Team, chaired by Mr. Johnson from Legislative Council. The reason I'm sharing that is it goes into some detail about the statutory ambiguities that exist in the law that make it very difficult to provide consistent and reliable advice to city officials. But before I get into the testimony, I would like to just take a moment to thank this committee for listening to the comments that have been provided by a number of different stakeholders over the interim, and it is evident based on the bills you've had drafted and the amendments you have drafted that this body has been listening. So I just wanted to acknowledge the committee. I also would like to acknowledge that in working with the Ethics Commission over the interim, that the Commission has been very responsive. We have utilized their services on a number of occasions in trying to work through some issues, and I just wanted to make that point on the record. The first issue that I think we want to take up is just that in Senate Bill 30, which removes the requirement to list the names of relatives and members of the household. There was one resignation at the City of Portland on the City's Landmarks Commission as a result of the increased requirements required by Senate Bill 10, that person had written a letter to the mayor indicating that they were that these requirements disrupted what they felt like they could give. Having said that, the ramifications of the reporting in other parts of the state have had serious consequences for leadership, and the City of Portland is very supportive of the League of Oregon Cities and their position on this bill, and so we are supportive of Senate Bill 30. I just want to go through the amendments really quite quickly. On the First Amendment, I think Mr. Snyder from the Association of Counties really clearly outlined what the major problem is with legislative or administrative interest, and that is the conflict that exists between the gift definition and the definition, or the gift prohibition, the definition of legislative or administrative interest. Let me give you an example about how that has been applied and the problems it has created in Portland. And this example is provided in the testimony. If there's a contractor who bids on a contract with Portland Parks and Recreation, that contractor has an economic interest in every single employee that works for Portland Parks and Recreation, no matter what their authority is. So the part-time lifeguard, that person's families and members of their household are subject to the gift prohibition in the same manner that the director of that bureau is. And so the Dash 1 amendments really get at this issue, an important issue of creating a nexus between the gift giver and the person to whom the gift is being given. At the end of the day, where we hope to get is in simplifying and clarifying this law so that when the city attorney's office is doing trainings with city employees and boards and commissions, they can communicate a very simple message. And that message is, If someone has an economic interest in the work you do, then the gift limits apply. And that seems to be a much easier message to deliver than whether a source has a legislative or administrative interest in your agency. It's just a source of a number of questions. People don't really, it's not very intuitive. People don't completely understand what it means. The dash ones help get to a point where it's a little bit more clear that that you can, it's a message that can be communicated more clearly. A couple of issues, though, that may need to be clarified. I think that the there may need to be some additional clarification about what it means to be subject to the action or vote of a public official. I think that that is, it may be something that can be clarified by this body or by the commission in rulemaking. On this, the 30-2 amendments, I will just echo what's already been said, which is that city officials are required to attend events as part of their positions, and this amendment makes it easier for people to do what they have been elected and appointed to do. The 30-3 amendments on the definition of public official, I think that issue has been addressed. We don't also do not know what it means to be an and or otherwise, but it is there may need to be some additional guidance about what it even means to be an agent, because we need to be able to wrap our arms around who does this law apply to, and the agent or otherwise makes it a little bit more complicated. Whether there's an attorney general opinion suggesting that someone who is performing governmental functions on behalf of the government is an agent or otherwise, but we still are not entirely clear about what that means. The city is also supportive of the 30-5 amendments, the gifts on the basis of personal friendship. As has been mentioned, there are a number of states, including Colorado, which is the state's that the language from Senate Bill 10 was actually drawn from the state of Colorado, but this amendment was not not included as well in Oregon's law. I think this is one of those things that is the source of a fair amount of frustration and surprise for city officials when we are doing trainings. Just to divert momentarily, after Ms. Reese, and sometimes I will be sitting in on those trainings, after we finish 1 hour on the state's ethics laws, the reactions tend to range from confused to angry to some level of shock. People just don't understand why the breadth of this law extends so far into their personal lives in things that have nothing to do with ethics and restrict behavior in ways that have nothing to do with what they perceive to be ethical conduct associated with their public position. Skipping to the dash 9 amendments, this issue we will agree is very important for anyone who serves on, particularly on boards and commissions, and that is to be really clear that gifts received in the course of outside relating to your outside business are not impacted under this law. What we would encourage is to look at that exemption a little bit more broadly to also apply to volunteer service and to people who are serving as a volunteer for charitable organizations, that the gifts received or even food and beverage that's provided to a whole board is not something that is prohibited or restricted by the gift law. So we have provided some language to that to suggest a clarification on that particular amendment. That is that's the substance of the written testimony that has been submitted. What I would I just want to raise two very quick or two issues very briefly that are not addressed in the amendments, and one of which has not been spoken about at this point, which is the issue of entertainment and gifts of entertainment. The way the law is currently written, there is one standard that applies to everything, and another standard that applies except entertainment, and another standard that applies to entertainment. There are only two very limited exemptions to the entertainment, and that is for whether it's incidental or received in some sort of ceremonial capacity. And that's an issue that I think just creates a great deal of confusion for people when we do trainings, that some people will think, well, these tickets were under $50. Well, the law says you can't receive tickets to anything under that circumstance. So there's really two different levels, and it creates some confusion. The other issue is that we have a number of city employees who, either within the course of their volunteerism, one example would be the in the Portland Police Bureau, there is a program through the Police Activities League that encourages youth and police to go to events together. And the Police Activities League donates tickets so that kids and police can build relationships going to these events. Well, a number of those events are banned or they can't receive the tickets because these are say, Trailblazers games or other types of events where the receipt of entertainment would be involved. So there are some things that fall outside of the intent of the legislature in terms of what the legislature had intended with Senate Bill 10 and with the state's ethics laws. Also, there are city employees who attend arts events because it is their job to monitor how public funds are being spent. And they cannot receive tickets to attend an event when the city has provided a grant to an organization. So there may be what I would hope that this committee will consider is whether it makes sense to also address some of these barriers on gifts of entertainment and maybe even clarify why there's even the distinction in the first place. So other than that, I think that there are probably some other housekeeping issues that could be addressed, and we'd be happy to work with legislative counsel on this bill. Thanks very much for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Reese, did you have anything to offer?
For the record, Lindley Reese, I think I was just here if there were questions relating to some of the amendments and the legal applicability.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dowry.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is David Dowry. I reside at 25204 Airport Road, Philomath, Oregon. I currently serve as a commissioner on the Benton County Planning Commission. I'm a citizen member on the Benton County Budget Committee, and I'm an elected board member on the Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District. It was only in 2007 I realized that in my new role on the Planning Commission that I was a public official. And with that, I was subject to Senate Bill 10. I wholeheartedly encourage you to modify Senate Bill 10 to change the reporting requirements that are unnecessarily intrusive and directly discourage participation of unpaid volunteers in government bodies. And this has been proven over the past 2 years by the number of resignations that have occurred. Specifically, I firmly support deleting the requirement to list relatives and members of your household who are 18 years of age and older. From my own situation, I had to list 16 people that range from my children to my wife's siblings and their spouses. As far as I could tell, I was not required to list the spouses of my children. That would have added two more. Normally, I would have called each person to ask permission from them to list them. But time was short, and I had to get on with it. And I also realized that a number of these people were out of state, and they wouldn't have any idea about the requirements here in the state of Oregon. So I went ahead and listed them. It would be great to change this requirement for this year, for reporting for 2008, if you could pass this quickly and have an emergency clause such that it could be changed, but that may be asking too much. I firmly support deleting the requirement to submit quarterly public official disclosures if there is nothing to report. This added paperwork is unnecessary and is an undue burden on the Government Ethics Commission. I firmly support deleting the requirement for the statements of economic interest and quarterly public official disclosure to be placed in a searchable database to be available over the Internet by 2010 or in 2010. I view this requirement as providing a potential of abuse through the invasion of privacy for myself my family, and our extended families. What is wrong with continuing to make these reports public record such that a person would need to make a written public records request to gain access to them? At least this way, there would be a paper trail to document who is looking at your records. Further, I firmly support modifying the civil penalties that can be invoked for late filing of either the annual and quarterly reports, particularly for volunteer positions. Currently, you have 15 days after the due date to file your report. If you don't do that, you can be assessed $10 a day for the next 14 days, and then $50 after that, up to a maximum of $5,000. To me, this is very harsh treatment for volunteers. This past year, the Government Ethics Commission waived these requirements for timeliness and did not impose penalties. It may be different this year, and certainly if volunteer positions are assessed penalties, I'm sure there'll be a reaction that will be coming to this room in the next legislative session. I appreciate the opportunity for presenting my views today. I agree with you wholeheartedly that we need to change the original Senate Bill 10 and encourage you in your efforts to do that. Thank you very much, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dowry. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming in here today. Ms. Eaton, will you please come forward? You have been in this building a long time. Not just today, but very much appreciate you coming in to testify. So, in fact, Ms. Eaton, I think when I was in the Rules Committee in the House, you were coming to testify on elections-related issues.
Thank you, Chair Dillon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As most of you know, the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed citizen participation in government. I will be brief. You've heard a lot of good testimony today. In 2005 and 2007, the League was very much involved with looking at the ethics laws of Oregon and working on Senate Bill 10 because we felt that this was an area in which the public had great concern, and we wanted to make as sure as possible that public officials are held accountable and responsible, and there is transparency in government. We strongly supported Senate Bill 10. That being said, the net that was cast by the administrative rules that brought in all kinds of folks that had to report, we felt, and you've heard certainly from local governments, what difficulty this has caused, and we strongly support Senate Bill 10, Senate Bill 30, which attempts to modify that so that you don't have the people caught in the net who really should not be there. I've had a chance just to look very not very closely, let's put it that way, at the amendments that are proposed. The amendments look pretty good, except I do have a question for clarification on the Dash 9 amendments. They simply take out all of Senate Bill 30 and insert just a portion of it. And so I want to ask if that was the intent, because all of the other amendments are very careful to say that they left 30 there and then added these other things. So my question was that an inadvertent admission or omission?
You are, even though you only had a chance just to peruse the amendments, you are very insightful.
because we have actually already put an inquiry into Legislative Council, believing that that may have not been the intent of the amendment
well,
that was requested.
We certainly would have opposed that amendment if that were true. The other amendments look to be addressing other questions that really do need to be addressed. And we appreciate the fact, as the commendations have come to you today, for the work that has been done in the interim to try to take care of the perhaps inadvertent problems that have arisen with the requirements for filing the EISs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming, Cappy. When you say it, just for the to clarify the record, when you say it casts too large a net, you're talking about the listing of family members.
That's it. We thought that the net that was cast was way too large.
But you're, to follow up, Mr. Chair, you're not advocating reducing the number of actual public officials.
The basic number, no,
we
are
not. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I understood your comments. And then when you commented on the amendments, you've had a chance to look at all the amendments?
Mm-hmm, but briefly.
And the league is generally in support?
Yes, I'm taking that on my own responsibility. I haven't run them by my action committee, but I didn't see anything in there that I felt we couldn't support.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, just a general question. You're a grassroots organization, and you know, I've worked with you in the past on many issues. Why do you suppose it is? I've been on the Rules Committee through the interim. This is probably my fourth or fifth hearing, including in Pendleton, where I saw some of Mr. Stoffel there. Why do you suppose that you are the very first person who's come forward to us to say anything positive about Senate Bill 10?
I don't know why, but the League has, when we were talking about casting the net, the League has a number of public issues that we are concerned about, and I should preface that by saying our board doesn't make the decisions about what we're going to bring to you. Our members have to have studied and agreed upon a position for us, and our position as far as public officials and government is concerned, that we want as much transparency as possible in the way in the public's business is conducted. And that's the basis for my being here.
And I do understand that. I guess I'm just curious as to why, you know, this is supposedly to benefit the public and make it more transparent, and yet we have not heard from anybody except you thus far to come forward with anything positive about
it. I'll have to stir the good government pot.
Well, we'll welcome them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Perry.
I'd like to join my colleague in thanking Ms. Eaton for her testimony. I appreciate it very much. And the League of Oregon, or the League of Women Voters, has been very active throughout the previous 3 years in trying to get ethics reform initially. So I think it's noteworthy that they're here today saying that course corrections, where they're needed, are supportable or a good thing. Mr. Chairman, we had earlier testimony about the net, and I'd like to just point out that we did go from a census of about 4,000 public officials that were required to file disclosure forms annually to roughly 30,000 filings that are now being tracked and analyzed and recorded and audited by the commission. And today, again, we've been informed, and I know that I agree with this, that there may be up to 200,000 Oregonians who fit the current definition of a public official. And I think that we need to look at that net and how widely that net gets cast as well, because I don't know whether the framers or the folks who are really intent on better disclosure and more transparency really thought that there would come a day when more than 5% of Oregon's population fits under the category of public official. It seems that we need to do some work here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Farioli. That closes our public hearing on SB 30. Just for the future of the committee, this committee does not regularly meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It actually meets on Fridays. But committee members have been good enough to agree for the first 6 weeks of this session so that we could particularly address this issue to meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays with the quid pro quo that the carrot chair would not call a meeting on Friday.
You can call a meeting on Friday.
Yeah. So there is no meeting this Friday. Next Tuesday, we are going to come back for a special SJR for the first part of the meeting. That will be posted. That's being brought by Senator Farioli, naming President Lincoln as an honorary governor of the state. We will actually also open up another hearing on SB 30 for public testimony, and the chair may have not additional amendments, but a few additional items to put before the committee to see if there's an interest in additional amendments in those areas. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make an observation I can based on some of the testimony we had and tying in some of the comments I'd made earlier. But what we have heard, I think, fits very well with what we're attempting to do to bring some clarity and transparency under the umbrella of the public good and the public right to know, and where the public good and the public right to know is irrelevant, and trying to find that nexus. But I really appreciate the work that a number of people are doing in trying to define what is truly a legislative or administrative interest of the individual, and in terms of public official, whether they have a right to influence. I mean, so we hear some of these very unusual stories that we have continued to hear, which actually erodes the public's confidence in us. Because, you know, the honest answer is, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is, people of Oregon don't want public officials to go to exotic places with professional lobbyists and taking their husband and wives and drinking a lot of alcohol and having great dinners. That's what they wanted to stop. You know, they didn't want to have to worry about whether they could get engaged to somebody, and they didn't want to have to worry about whether, you know, they can go to somebody's house. And so that's when we talk about the public good. But I think we're really starting to hone in on this, folks, with the legislative administration instance and what the public official's ability to control is. And what I would ask is that rather than look at the relative issues or whatever, like on the statement of economic interest, if we could better define, as we're getting closer to what a true ability to influence and a legislative or administrative interest is, have that be the overall umbrella at the top of that form. And whether it's your income or your relatives, only if they meet that definition do they become listed. Then I think you solve all these issues. Because frankly, I think you need to put a relative debt down. If I have a cousin or brother, and he has a big ethanol plant in eastern Oregon, and he's coming for $150,000 tax credit, he should be listed on my form, not because just he's my brother or cousin, but because he has a true legislative interest. And no other family member who doesn't need to be listed. And I think if we apply that standard to, you know, income, relatives, that just, I think, solves all those types of issues. Because the public does have a right to know when someone really has a legitimate, distinct from the general public, influence that I might have. But the rest of it really does not meet the public good. And I just think if we can start with that and apply that standard, then all these other issues are easily remedied. So that's just my general thought on that. And I think as we hear all, rather than trying to tweak some of these things, if we just understand of why would it apply, and if it would apply, then that would be a standard that would affect all the different peculiarities, I think, of the statement of economic interest and the gift issue that we continue to struggle with.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to just make a comment, too, that I was very heartened by the comments of the League of Women Voters about understanding the importance of really trying to focus this law. And it was kind of brought into, I mean, the importance of that was kind of emphasized to me. There's somebody out in the audience who works with volunteer firefighters. We all know who she is, but she sent me this note in response to my question about whether disclosure should be required if for volunteer people who are joining boards, whether they should know in advance what their responsibilities and liabilities are. And she said, and I did ask her permission to read from this. She said, I'm currently involved in campaigns around the state to attract and recruit volunteer firefighters. They often ask about training and other requirements. I would be very, 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 that's four of them, nervous about disclosing to a prospective volunteer firefighter that he or she could be personally liable for violations that are far overreaching and difficult to understand. And I think that really sums up what we're trying to do here. This is a net, as Ms. Eaton said, that has been extended too far. And so I want to just say that I'm glad this committee is addressing this so seriously, and you in particular, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. All right, thank you, Senator Burdick. I do believe part of that issue is being addressed with the changes in administrative and legislative interest and the definitions of public officials. There may be some additional clarification that needs to occur there. But we will be adjourned till next Tuesday for this committee, and we will have the joint resolution before the committee first, and then we will have a public hearing for approximately 1 hour thereafter, for 1 hour period thereafter.